The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 73.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, a recurring guest, a good buddy of mine. He's got one of the most popular podcasts out there, Quote the Raven. His name is Chris Irons. Chris, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
George, it is lovely to finally be with you now that we got our shit set up properly. Which George and I have been messing around with the computer for the last hour, which is it'll be on the behind the scenes footage.
You old
men trying to figure out technology.
Yeah, it's like that scene at the end of Zoolander. Remember when they're like the apes trying to get into that computer?
The files are in the computer.
Yeah, right. Exactly. All right. So you've had some great podcasts lately, by the way. The one that you did with Schiff was fantastic. You know what I like most about that is you always hear Schiff talking his live streams, and I listen to his podcast all the time. He's great. But you never kind of get the behind the scenes. And I think that's one thing you do so well when you're talking to these guys is you get them to really open up. And, you know, he was talking about how he's doing chin-ups in his tennis court.
I know.
that was just priceless.
He just went off at one point, too. He just started talking about his workout routine and his diet, and he called Kim Jong-un a fat ass, and, like, did all this. I was like, as it was happening, I was like, this is great. I said, I wonder if Peter's drunk. I hope he is. But yeah. I'm glad. I hope he feels comfortable enough to let loose a little bit. And that's the vibe I want to have on my podcast. You know, I want to take these stuffy financial types and, you know, have them feel comfortable and feel like, because at the end of the day, I've met a lot of these people in person, and a lot of times they don't say publicly what they say in person. You know, you'll meet somebody backstage at a conference and they'll be chugging whiskey and cursing under their breath. And then they get on stage trying to be all polished, you know?
Right.
She's like, come on, just, we've had enough of the act. We just want to talk. It's, you know, let's just shoot the shit.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of credit goes to you, because as I've been interviewing more and more people, you start to understand how actually hard it is to interview someone well and ask the right questions at the right time, but let them talk. And there's a lot to it, especially when, I don't know about you, but for me, when I'm interviewing people that I've looked up to and I've learned so much from, like Schiff or Jim Rogers, someone like that, that you're always kind of on edge. Let's make sure I do this right, because I got one shot at it. But it is definitely a skill to get people to open up and really give people insights that they might not have heard otherwise. And I think you just did a fantastic job. But let me get into more market stuff. I know that's why people are tuning in, to get your opinion on that. So just I'll pass the baton to you, and you can just take it and run with it. What do you think of the markets right now? What's going through your head? What have you been thinking about the last week or so?
I don't really know. Well, I just did a podcast yesterday on how ridiculous I thought it was that everybody was swooning over what Warren Buffett said over the weekend. You know, essentially, everybody on CNBC and I pointed out that Buffett had his shareholder meeting on Saturday. All right. And he famously came out and said he wasn't going to get back into the airlines because he thought the airline business was going to be different post-pandemic than it is now. And when he was asked about what he was looking at buying or where the value was, he said that the Fed came in and bought everything before he could. So the Fed, who has really been one of Warren Buffett's best tailwinds over the last 3 or 4 decades, priced him out of the market, which I find to be absolutely hilarious. I find that to be very comical because, you know, I know Warren Buffett's a savvy investor, but I raised the question of whether or not he would be as savvy, you know, or considered to be the genius that he is if he didn't have massive help from the central banks. And now it's like, live by the crony capitalism sword, die by the crony capitalism sword. He had to come out and kind of begrudgingly admit that there was nothing left to buy because the Fed came in and rescued the market so quick. So I thought that was hilarious. And then something that I kind of thought was pathetic was the financial media kind of grabbing on to what he said over the weekend and treating it as though it was the first piece of analysis that they've heard since the beginning of this pandemic, and completely basing their content all day yesterday, for the most part, from what I saw, and what they were putting, you know, what Scott Wapner was tweeting on Sunday. He was making this big deal Sunday. He was like, his tweets, George, were like, the first one was like, Warren Buffett thinks things aren't going well and he's out of the airlines and he didn't find anything to buy. And then you can see his tweets escalate. And then it's like, can you believe there's 30 million people unemployed? Like, this is appalling. This is abhorrent. It's like, yeah, we know. We've been talking about it for the last 2 months. You know, it's like, it took Warren Buffett to jar the shit in your head loose to make you finally realize that, like, oh, this is a problem. And similarly, yesterday, Jim Cramer, and this, I talked about this on my podcast yesterday, Cramer came out for the first time ever that I've seen and told people, start selling some of your index funds. You know, which he did. Yeah, he said if the...
See, I have to get my info from you because I never watch CNBC or anything like that. So I just have to get my CNBC info from either talking to you live or just your Twitter feed.
This came across on an article yesterday on Twitter. And I guess, you know, when he gets done with Mad Money, some intern has to write up everything that he says and put it out as an article on CNBC.com.
Right.
And that article said, basically, you know, what Warren Buffett said over the weekend was alarming, and I want you to start to sell your index funds, you know, which I've never heard him say before. Every time I've ever heard him talk, he has said, I want you in an S&P index fund. I want you in an S&P, you know, for 10 years, I've been listening to him say, I want you in an S&P index fund. But now that the fucking Oracle from Omaha comes out and says he's been priced out of the market by the Fed, all of a sudden, everybody is having a wake-up call and saying, oh, you know, maybe things aren't perfect here, which I almost find is like a contrarian indicator. What I said yesterday on my podcast was like, I wouldn't be surprised if the market goes straight up now, because the fact of the matter is, even though Buffett has been priced out of the market and that he sees no value, I mean, it doesn't mean that this crazy psychotic tailwind of stimulus isn't going to continue to drive the market higher. So here we are today. I know it's just one day, and one day a pattern does not make, but you know, first day after Cramer says that, Dow's up 400 points. You know, just something to have fun with. I just found it pathetic, though, that people trump his, or people they cling to his narrative.
Yeah, totally.
Like it's the end all be all. And I said very simply, he gets things wrong. And if you need proof, just know that he was in the airlines. Okay. Yeah. The airlines just got clobbered and he took his loss on that. So it's possible for this guy to be wrong. Has he been the best? Yeah, he's been the best in this Keynesian bubble where everything exists, you know, but he's not capable of looking from the outside in. He's looking from the inside out with the rest of these fucks that are on television, right? And these portfolio advisors that collect their 2 and 20 to put people into index funds so that they can turn around and make topical conversation with their LPs and with their clients about, hey, here's what Warren Buffett said, you know, because it's a headline. And it's a headline that people on Main Street realize when Buffett says something. So everybody in the Keynesian bubble clings to his shit like immediately, and that becomes the gospel. And then watching that for the last like 72 hours, I just think it's pathetic. I think it's pathetic that people can't make up their own minds. And I think it's pathetic that it took that for people to realize how dire the situation is. And again, I think he is, okay, his reputation as the best is deserved, but he's the best within the confines of the Keynesian system. Yeah. And for those of us that look from the outside in, right, we understand that. We understand he's the best in that system. And if things go haywire and the system is disrupted, he may not be the best. People from the inside looking out, like him and like the people that cling to every word that he says on CNBC, those people are incapable of looking from the outside in. So we're like the universal, you know, the universal donor, whatever you want to call it, and they can only see one way, right?
Yeah.
That's a terrible analogy.
No, but I mean, the bottom line is you talk about this Keynesian approach that he's done well in, and who knows how he would have done. It's impossible to know. But what you're referring to specifically is artificially low interest rates, having a Fed put to where if the market goes down by 3%, they're coming in and printing more money or doing $1 trillion a day in the repo market, or quantitative easing, expanding their balance sheet from $800 billion in 2007 to $8 trillion today, or darn near close to it. And so you have to ask yourself, you know, how would he have done without all the money printing, with all without all the debt, and without the artificially low interest rates since, call it, the late 80s? And it may have been
a little bit different. That's what I said. I give him credit for the decades where he invested when there was sound money, you know.
Yeah, I want to be very clear. I want to take
anything away from Buffett. What does his performance look like over the last 30 years if the market doesn't hold up the way that it does? And the market holds up because of the central banks. I mean, Berkshire Hathaway is, in essence, it's an index, right? So rising tide lifts all boats.
Yeah, and I want to give him a lot of credit because I haven't done a lot of research on Buffett like I have other investors, but I know he did extremely well even prior to the 1980s, but that's when his fund was, he had a lot less money. And as you know, it's a lot easier to make outsized returns when you're dealing with 50 million or 100 million as opposed to 50 billion or 10 billion, something like that. It's just a completely different game. But I definitely want to give him credit there. But you know, one thing I think it's interesting that you touched on is this view that Buffett's always right. But it seems like the same people that have that view are the same people that always tell you on Twitter that the market always goes up over time. And then when you say, well, show me the data that you're looking at, and then they'll just show you a chart of like the last 10 years, or at the very most, they'll show you a chart going back to like 1981. So all they do is they pick this time frame where we've had a down cycle in interest rates from, call it, 20% down to zero, and say, look, Chris, the market goes up all the time. What are you doing? You got to buy the dip. What do you say to those people?
Well, they should be looking at the Dow priced in gold, first off, if they want to, you know, see the market outperform. They should be looking at the market priced in real money, right? I mean, we all know gold is the only real money.
Right.
It's that simple. It's been real money for thousands of years. Nothing's going to change that. The dollar will come and go until we get the dollar 2.0 or the dollar Bitcoin or whatever the fuck is next. But yeah, you're 100% right. I mean, people have a very close zoom on things. They see 10 years, they see even 2-3 decades, whatever. But, you know, it's time that is going to act as the sunlight and the disinfectant for this Keynesian experiment. And the longer we perpetuate this nonsense, the worse it's going to be. Who knows how long we can do it? 50 years, 100 years? I mean, I joked on my podcast yesterday. I said, I hope it falls apart after I die, because there's going to be real austerity, and there's going to be it's going to be real civil unrest. It's going to make the pandemic look like nothing, you know, and people say, oh, it can't happen. It'll never happen. Hey, things come out of nowhere. All right. The coronavirus came out of nowhere. Even for guys like us, we were talking about it in January this year. I mean, it blindsided the world. You know, one morning we went to sleep and the next morning it was there. So people that say the hyperinflation scenario or the dollar, you know, destruction scenario can't happen, I think are sadly mistaken. And like on every other issue, they won't realize it and or admit to it until it's too late, until it just punts them right in the balls and it's right on their front porch and they can't deny it. So whatever, we'll let them deal with it. You know, but again, this is like a PR stunt, right? Say you're an unnamed CNBC anchor that also has a wealth management business, right? That depends on bringing in clients and managing their funds. You know, the retail investors of the world are used to the narrative. It's been kind of indoctrinated into people that you always buy low and the market always goes up. And nobody's better at that. Nobody understands why that happens. But let's just forget that.
Yeah, but people don't buy low. They don't buy low, Chris. They buy high and want it to go higher.
Well, nobody is better at that system than Buffett, right? And I saw this. I saw this in March when the market started to crash. I saw all these people on my Facebook feed who are, you know, friends, people that I went to high school with, people that are not in the financial world. I mean, you know, my friends from South Philadelphia, you know, my plumbers, my electricians, my welders, all my drinking buddies, really. I watched them all post on there, all right, now's the time to get in, you know, buy when there's weakness, whatever. You know, I'm looking, and I had people messaging me too. Hey, I got $500. I'm looking to allocate some capital somewhere. You know, what do you think's a good thing to, you know? So people have heard this bullshit their whole life. And when the market crashes, that little monkey on a wheel starts running in their head. And they start thinking like, oh, yeah, market low, time to buy. Because then the market eventually goes up.
Yeah, because they weren't alive prior to 1981. They've only lived in a down cycle of interest
rates. Right. And they've said things to me like, oh, this is the time to get in for the long term. This is the time for so-and-so's retirement or so-and-so's college fund. So you hear all these like Buffett-esque kind of quotes come out of people. But again, go back to my analogy where you're this wealth manager, right? Like, why is it important that you cling to everything Buffett says? Well, one of two reasons. One, you either believe that everything he says is the gospel, in which case you're not a think for yourselfer. So in my opinion, you shouldn't be managing money, but that's your client's problem, not your problem. Or two, or B, it becomes topical with your clients. You know, it's something to kind of like point out and say to your clients, well, Warren Buffett said this, and I watched the whole fucking meeting, so I must be the best. Let's take what he said into consideration, you know? And there was no better example of this than in March when Josh Brown posted on Twitter, hey, Becky Quick is going to be talking to Warren Buffett. Who would you rather hear from at a time when the market is crashing than Warren Buffett? And I replied to his tweet. And I said, there's a lot of people I'd rather hear from. I'd rather hear from Peter Schiff. I'd rather hear from Guy Adami. I'd rather hear from Bill Fleckenstein. Anybody. I know what Buffett's going to say. Hey, you know, we got to find value, which is the discounted sum of future cash flows. Right? That's what Buffett's going to say. Macro level, bird's eye view. I don't know what companies he's going to single out, but whatever. I generally get the gist of what he's saying. And Josh Brown responded to me, you would rather hear from Guy Adami than Warren Buffett? And even Guy Adami wrote, you know, like, leave me out of this or whatever. I'd rather hear from Buffett. And I said, yeah, I would rather hear from Guy Adami because I've seen Guy Adami operate in the bubble and pick stocks that he likes and ride the Keynesian wave. And I've also seen Guy Adami step out of the bubble and talk about central banking and criticize central banks and be skeptical of our system and raise questions about moral hazard.
Yeah.
So that's what I want to hear. And the point is, when he said that, about 2 days later, Guy Adami went on that rant on CNBC that I tweeted out, and the video like went viral. It got like 1,000 retweets because he basically said on Fast Money, hey, I don't know if the Fed's really doing some crazy shit here. I mean, we should all be paying attention, whatever. And that went viral. And why did it go viral? Because that's what people really needed to hear at that point. So that's why I would rather hear from Guy Adami than Warren Buffett. I understand he's everybody else's savior, and I respect the guy, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, comparing Buffett or trying to find someone at his level of notoriety that I would prefer to hear from, probably Druckenmiller.
Right. Oh, yeah. 100% I'd rather hear from Druckenmiller.
Yeah, just because Druckenmiller, you know, he's gone. You know he can make money in any market, not only in the United States and the entire world in FX and bonds and equities. He's been critical of the Fed, but he's also complimented the Fed, you know?
Right.
He really, you can tell he doesn't pull any punches, but he also doesn't have any favorites. He can, you know, one day he can wake up and be very bullish. The next day he can be very bearish. And you've got to respect that about it. Where Buffett, to your point, you know what he's going to say. And he kind of hints at what he really believes with an overtone of the stock market's the greatest, the S&P's the best, you're never going to go wrong.
And America's the greatest. Don't bet against America. Yeah, you know, this, I don't know if he really believes that. He might, but it's also a convenient PR narrative for him. It makes him look great. I mean, that's all I'm going to say.
I don't want to throw anything out there that's conspiratorial, but I just, before I retired, I learned very quickly that the more success you have, especially in the United States, the bigger target you have on your back.
Right.
And I personally learned that the hard way. And I often wonder if guys like Buffett kind of toe that narrative just because they know they are so well known that if they, let's say, piss off the wrong person, it could make their life a lot more difficult than it needs to be.
You don't think that he, you know, it's a coincidence that he only talks to Becky Quick, you know? I mean, the guy has a skillful PR narrative that's just, you know, the guy that he comes off at versus the guy that sits down at the negotiating table. We both know, we're both smart enough to understand, they're two completely different people.
Yeah,
it's that simple. But the point is, there is a thirst out there for reality and for people to. Another thing I said, I don't want to repeat everything I said on my podcast yesterday, but another thing I said was this whole deal now with people going on Reddit and making memes that are making fun of the Fed and making fun of Jerome Powell and the Money Printer Go Burr group and all this shit. A lot of the Bitcoin guys are into it, whatever. All that is the mainstream, the everyday person, just understanding on their own, without your help or my help or anybody's help, I don't think, that what the Fed is doing is ridiculous. We saw it with Dave Portnoy, who's like the world's worst fucking trader, okay, who just started day trading like a month ago. Even he got on his live stream, the guy from Barstool Sports, and said they can just print money out of nowhere. It's shrimp bucks, you know, like from the office. He's making its monopoly money. I mean, it's a very simple concept. And the Fed is not going to be able to, they might be able to control the amount that's printed or not printed, but they're not going to be able to control whether or not they have the confidence of people or not. And the reason that your YouTube channel now has over 100,000 subscribers, by the way, congratulations.
Thank you.
The reason is because there's a thirst out there for some truth and for at least some acknowledgement, okay, that there is more than meets the eye when CNBC peddles a narrative, or when Warren Buffett peddles a narrative, or when Neil Kashkari goes on 60 Minutes. There's more. And people are not stupid. People know that. So to have somebody like you acknowledge that, people are thirsty for that, man. Your viewers, they want to look at that bubble. They understand that, you know, everything that happens, our capital markets, everything else, they're all in this little bubble. But they want to look at it from the outside too. They want to see bigger picture. And again, I was talking before about timelines. Same style of question, right? The Keynesians, they want to look at 5 years, 10 years, 15 years and fix this now and worry about it later. And this is how the economic machine works and whatever. And Austrians, we want to look at how will this affect 100 years, 200 years? And why are we ignoring these economic laws that have driven everything as we know it for the thousands of years? Thousands of gold has been money for thousands of years. So how arrogant and stupid are we to think that we can stand in front of that moving train that's been doing 100 miles an hour for millennium that we're going to be the ones that stop it? So you can pick, you know, your viewers, they take the long view. They take the large philosophical and ideological view. And we both have that view as well. Doesn't mean George Gammon and Chris Irons are not capable of looking at what that might do to the market over the next month. We're not, you know, we can do that. We just, I think our default view, it's like in a video game, you know, when you switch the camera view that you're using, I think our default view is just a lot wider.
I find it interesting as I've become more involved with Twitter and YouTube and interviewing people, that the people that are trained economists that come from an academic background, they're the ones that really see Keynesian economics as a proper tool and a solution. And they're typically the people that really value models, and they were also good students by definition. So you think of a good student, and that's someone that you give them an assignment, or you give them a structure or a list of instructions, and then they can execute
they stay within those confines. Right. Yeah, exactly.
That's right. Or you take someone like me, where I was a terrible student. I almost flunked out of high school. And I also have had the opportunity lately to interview guys like Robert Kiyosaki, who was a horrible student as well. And you look at these guys, and it's kind of interesting and it's not 100% across the board, but a lot of the guys that didn't do well in school but did really well in the game of life tend to be more kind of Austrian mentality. And the people who did really, really well in school, from what I've seen, kind of tend to be more Keynesian and have a greater belief in the capabilities of the government. And
the fact of the matter is, you can't do great in life if you start a business and then lever yourself up to the tits.
You're right.
Spend and spend and spend and have a terrible balance sheet and focus only on the things that Keynesians focus on. You just won't be successful. I mean, you talk about common sense. What if we ran a private business, George, the same way that the government runs its own balance sheet? We would be running at a loss every single year. Every year we would be burning cash. We would be over-levered. And then the first major problem that we'd have, we would go under. You know, you have to have an Austrian mindset. Doesn't mean you can't allocate capital. It doesn't mean that you can't buy back your own stock. It doesn't mean any of these things. Just means that you have to have yourself in a stable financial position before doing so. You have to recognize, you know, how valuable equity and savings are so that you have them for capital investment. Tesla's the exception, right? They come out and burn billions of dollars, and for some reason our market has afforded them $100 billion market cap. I don't know how long that'll last. But the reason that people of days of yonder have had success, like you're talking about, is because they had that mindset. They had that Austrian mindset. And it is just common sense. And to go back to what you just said, I don't want to tell anybody who's right or wrong or whatever. We are right, George. We are. It's like what Peter Schiff said in that interview when he was arguing with that woman. You don't pay off debt by going further into debt. And the woman's like, you're fundamentally wrong. It's like, no, moron, you're fundamentally wrong. You don't pay off debt by taking up more debt. This is, we're going back to the Econ 101, the very first tiny little rules of economics, you know, the smallest things that we've built this whole disgusting system on. We have to respect those small things. Otherwise, the whole thing is going to collapse. Yeah. It's going to collapse, but it'll collapse a lot sooner.
Yeah, and I also want to point out that people like Schiff, I know the big knock from the Keynesians or maybe the MMT side is that he really doesn't understand money creation, or he doesn't understand the modern day financial system or monetary system. That's not true. I've spoken with Peter. I know you've interviewed him a lot more than I have, but I purposely asked him some questions to kind of get to the bottom of it there, just to, because I knew that he understood that, and I just wanted him to show that, because a lot of times he's very similar to Rogers in the sense that they'll give these broad strokes that the everyday person can understand, and that's why they're so popular. But then, you know, from the CNBC types and the talking heads, they catch a lot of flack because, oh, they're just, you know, these rubes out there that really don't know anything about proper economics or the modern day world. But then what's interesting, if you push them a little bit, you see that they truly, truly understand how things work.
He knows his shit. I mean, he's filthy. Like, he can get into the weeds.
Yeah,
on anything, you know, whatever. Hey, let's talk about the velocity of money. Let's talk about the PCE deflator, whatever. I mean, he'll go there. And, you know, it's not a joke. It's not a fluke with him. I mean, this is how the guy feels. When I first met him for a drink 2 years ago, we spoke at the same conference in New York City. And I met him and his son, Spencer, for a drink at a restaurant. They were getting ready to have dinner or whatever. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to kind of figure out going in was like, is this all an act? I mean, yeah. I know he's an extraordinarily successful businessman. You know, and I know he sells gold for a living, and I know the number one critique of him is if he's selling gold for a living and he's trying to bring on clients, you know, it's all just a money grab, whatever.
Right.
And, you know, we had a couple of Manhattans, and he was speaking honestly and freely. I mean, he was fucking slouched over his chair, I mean, with the tie undone. You know, we were having a conversation just as two. And it was evident to me, not only did he firmly believe in what he was saying, but that he was the real deal and he was very smart. And as he said on my podcast, you know, he went into selling gold because he thought gold was the way to go, not the other way around.
Yeah, I think, you know, most people think it's the other way around, and I don't think it is.
No, he's just taking an even bigger bet. He's not just betting his personal, you know, account on gold, and he's not just owning gold. He wants to be in the business of gold too. He's making as big of a bet as an entrepreneur as you can to back up his stance that gold will appreciate. And I agree with him.
Yeah, I think so too. What's your take on Bitcoin? And with the halving, do you pay any attention to that?
You know, it's funny that you ask, because some guy just messaged me, wants me to go on some Bitcoin podcast, and somebody else just wrote me a message that we need to convert you to the Bitcoin side, and I'm just not there yet. I mean, I own a little bit. I own what would amount to 0.01% of my capital. About that.
I thought you were going to say of one.
No. I'm trying to just give you an idea of my, you know, weighting.
Right.
Not a percent. Actually, it would be a tenth of a percent. It would be a tenth of a percent of my total capital is what it would be. You know, I think it's, I don't really know what to think. I don't want to go full tilt and say it's worthless and it'll be nothing and it'll always be worth nothing, because we run on a fiat system now where the paper we have isn't worth anything either. So, you know, for them to adopt Bitcoin and then use it as the standard, it wouldn't totally surprise me. I think it's possible, but I don't think it's likely. I think what's more likely is that countries will start to adopt their own digital currencies and Bitcoin will become illegal. I think that may be the direction we move in. And who knows whether that's a positive or a negative. That might send the price of Bitcoin to 100,000. I mean, who knows? For me, the big problem with Bitcoin that I have not been able to get over is the fact that you need power and you need an internet connection. That's it. You know, if I understand people say, like, oh, you're making the argument that if, you know, we enter into a nuclear holocaust, we'll have other problems to worry about and your gold won't do you any good then either. But I don't think that's the case. And then stupid people that have never owned gold before, like, what are you going to do? Put your gold in a sack and carry it with you? I'm like, do you even know what an ounce of gold feels like? Like, do you know, like, you could put your entire net worth, sell your house and your life savings into like half of a shoebox in gold. Like, there's nothing to it, right? I just can't get over the fact that Bitcoin has to be transacted electronically. And another thing people say is like, oh, well, you know what? We've had power ever since power was a thing, ever since electricity was a thing. We've had it, you know, in all the first world countries without interruption. And that may be the case, you know, but I think there are risks, like things that other people don't think about. You know, like solar flares is one that I think about all the time. You know, we could wind up getting a solar flare or one of these coronal mass ejections that could basically act as an EMP and take down the power grid. So, like, what happens if there's no power? How do you transact your Bitcoin? I don't know. I mean, you can ask the same question about gold. How do you transact your gold? I don't know. You know, I own silver too. That might be a little bit easier. But I don't like the idea of not being able to reach out and touch it.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's just something
completely separate things. I just see physical gold as an insurance policy. So I just try to segment my portfolio.
Well, what do you think about Bitcoin?
I think it's a great speculation, but it's a speculation.
That's where I am.
It's not insurance. It's not digital gold. It's not any of those things. It's got a tremendous asymmetry to it. It could go to zero, but to your point, it could go to 100,000. It could go to 1,000,000.
Right. So that's where I am too.
Yeah, that's an asymmetric bet right there that you probably want to take if you think that it's a good price right now. It's very difficult to say, is it cheap? Is it expensive? Because I like going back and looking at historical charts, and you don't have much of a history there with Bitcoin. But I totally get
you can't value it. I mean, it's one of those things. I own it because if it goes to zero tomorrow, it's not going to mean anything to me.
Yeah.
But I also feel like it's one of those things because it's electronic and because it's digital and because it's so volatile and so unpredictable that we could just wake up one morning and it could be at 500,000 just fucking because, you know, I don't know.
I just think it's a great speculation. But I just think it needs to be seen as a speculation. And as long as you treat it that way and kind of with kid gloves in your portfolio, then you could be a big winner in the long run.
It's totally unpredictable.
The concern with Bitcoin is the political side of it more than the electrical side of it. And I know that the pushback is, well, governments can never ban it because it's decentralized and because of all these reasons. And I totally understand that. But just because they can't really technically ban it, they can make it illegal, just like drugs. And, you know, drugs.
Right. Or they can ban the wallets, you know, the methods for transacting it. They can do, if the government wants to try to make Bitcoin go bye-bye, there's a lot of strings that they could pull. Yeah. There's a lot of strings that they could pull. I understand. I like the decentralized argument. I like the idea of Bitcoin. I really do. I love it. I love the fact that it's decentralized. I love the fact that it's person to person. It doesn't involve anybody else. And I love the fact that there's a limited supply. I love all those things.
So do I.
I can't get over the one issue with the power. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm old school.
All right. So I totally understand where you're coming from with Bitcoin. With CNBC, I know how they always take what Buffett said and they kind of try to put a positive spin on it. Did they do that with his meeting and his speech the other day, or was it pretty straightforward? What was your take on that?
Well, no, I just noticed that they were morose after finding out that he didn't buy anything. It was like everybody's been talking for the last couple months, like, what's Buffett buying? Is Buffett in Boeing? Is Buffett in American Express? Is Buffett in this? Is Buffett in that?
Expecting him because they wanted this big kind of sugar rush and they didn't get it.
Yeah, yeah, or like a big reveal, or that there was going to be a big headline, and he sat up there kind of looking, you know, not depressed, but I didn't find the meeting to be especially enthralling. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm too harsh of a critic. I don't know.
Didn't he talk about his cash position?
What's that? He did. Yeah, it's $137 billion now, by the way, his friends that priced him out of the equity market over at the Fed are doing everything they can to make sure that $137 billion depreciates in terms of purchasing power as quickly as possible.
Right. I think he's got it all in T-bills pretty much. So how does that compare to his cash position as a percentage of his portfolio going back, call it 20, 30 years, back to 1980 or so? Do you have any idea?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I know from what I've heard on the mainstream media that it's, I think, sizable as a percentage of his portfolio.
What types of charts do you look at? And would you consider yourself more of a tops down, like a macro guy first, and then you get into the businesses? Because I know you're really good at analyzing balance sheets and P&Ls and financial statements. So with your investing framework that you use for your own portfolio, where do you start?
I start with the company, usually. 9 times out of 10, I start with the company.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, you want to always be mindful of whether the sector is experiencing tailwinds, or, you know, there's some airlines that probably looked very cheap if you were looking at their 2020, you know, estimated earnings 2 months ago, but you had to be cognizant of the fact that the entire industry had just basically stopped, right?
Yeah.
So you can't ignore the macro picture, but 9 times out of 10, and what I'm looking for the most part is, when I invest in equities, is I look for special situations. I'm looking for like value to be unlocked, or even if it's, you know, a situation where there's an activist in there and they're trying to unlock value, You know, I like to look at those types of cases. I like to look at names that are polarizing. I like to look at names that get a ton of coverage, whether for good or for bad reasons. I find that that's where the most opportunity is if you can kind of assess. What I've always been good at, what I think I've always been good at, is being able to, you know, a special situation is called a special situation because it is a situation where if you can figure out and perform the analysis correctly faster than anybody else, you're almost assuredly going to make outsized returns, right?
Yeah, edge.
So, yeah. Right, a special situation can be anything. So let's say it's a rumor on a merger or an acquisition, right? And it's a stock that's trading at 50, but the rumor price is, you know, 60, right? And you can figure out that the merger is going to go through. Well, you're entitled to that arbitrage then if you think it, if your analysis says it's going to go through. But if the stock was trading at 40 before and you think that the company that is rumored to be acquiring them doesn't have the financial means to pull it off, you know, you can make money going the other way. It's just a question of, you know, special situations are like these things where the market kind of jars the price of something loose.
Right.
And it's this race to see where it's going to like eventually revert to, right? It's like a dog walking off a path. You know, if you're walking this way down a path and the dog's wandering up and down and up and down, you know, at some point the dog is going to revert to wherever the path is. So it's your job to try and find the path before the rest of the market figures it out. And a special situation is generally an event, whether it's a short report, whether it's a merger and acquisition rumor, whether it's a, you know, a rumor about a bankruptcy, whether it's a executive change, whatever. A special situation is a huge shock to the market usually, and then a scramble to figure out which likely outcome is going to occur. And that those are situations that I like to look at. I like to try and analyze and get to the bottom of before the rest of the market. And if I can't, then I usually wait on them. And if I can, then sometimes I take sizable swings.
It seems like that type of approach would remove the Fed to a certain degree as well, where if you're just betting on the S&P short or long, you know, you've really got to pay attention to what the Fed's doing. You've got to be able to predict that. But with an individual business, especially in these specialty situations you're referring to,
right,
it might not really matter what type of four-letter or five-letter program the Fed just set up. It's still going to move the price one way or the other.
And it's almost like macro is the uncertainty.
Yeah.
Right. People say, oh, there's an unlimited Fed put and there's unlimited cash to hold up markets and all this other shit. But the point of the matter is what we're doing is unprecedented. So, George, you and I are your viewers and my podcast listeners. Nobody knows if we're going to, tomorrow's the day we're going to wake up and confidence in the Fed will have been lost. And I don't know what the catalyst will be to that. Maybe it'll be Warren Buffett dies. Maybe it'll be Jeff Gundlach says something on CNBC. Maybe it'll be the crypto market imploding. I don't know what it'll be. But what I know is what we're doing now is unprecedented. Right. And so with unprecedented paths come unprecedented outcomes. And I really don't know. The Dow could be at 40,000 or 10,000 by the end of this year. And I wouldn't be surprised either way. I mean, how ridiculous is that?
Yeah.
I mean, if we had a real market, it would be very easy to say, well, the economy's getting plowed, earnings are coming down, you know, we're in a lot of trouble. I expect to see the market much lower at the end of this year from where it is right now. That would be like normal free market. But with the Fed in there, it's like, who the fuck knows? It's a free-for-all, you know? And these geniuses at the Fed don't understand that at this point, you know, they're adding to the volatility instead of squelching it. So for me, when you look at a special situation in a company, everything exists kind of within the ecosystem of the company. If the company owns 100 acres of land in Guatemala, well, that's 100 acres of land in Guatemala. And that's not going to change no matter what the Fed does.
Yeah. Did you see Einhorn's deal on Zero Hedge the other day?
His letter?
Oh yeah, I think it was a clip or a summary of his letter or a paragraph or two.
I read some of it, but not all of it. I read what he said on Tesla, and I think that's it. What else did he say? Do you want to inform me?
Yeah, he elaborated on inflation quite a bit.
What did he say?
He says he sees inflation coming down the pipeline quite heavily because of the supply side, not necessarily the demand side from the
interesting.
From the I'd have to go back and reread it, but I know that's what I remembered from the article. And because it really resonated with me, because that's something I've been saying in a lot of my videos, is people, and as you know, all Keynesians are just looking at the demand side of the equation pretty much.
Right.
And to completely ignore the supply side. But when you're looking at inflation or deflation, you've got to look at money supply, you got to look at velocity, but you've got to also look at the demand side. If it's going down, okay, fine, it's going down, but is supply going down even faster?
Right.
And so he said that demand or supply destruction will most likely outpace the lowering of the demand, and therefore you could see some substantial inflation.
And I think that's something we have to stay very cognizant of, because if they both come down at the same time, well, then we don't really see an acceleration or deceleration of inflation, you know, or if they both rise at the same time. But yeah, it's how those two sides of the equation kind of work with each other. And, you know, so far we haven't seen anything pronounced, but I think that's going to change. The macro economy as a whole is a special situation right now, meaning it was just hit with a giant shockwave, and all ends of this equation are going to be thrown out of balance and already are thrown out of balance. Now it's just a question of where reversion to the mean looks like. You have supply shock, you have demand shock, and you got Neil Kashkari in there pressing buttons at the New York Fed. You got to put all those things into a cocktail blender, and nobody knows what the hell you're going to pour out at the end of that concoction. The only thing I know is I don't want to drink it. And you know what? I met with David Einhorn last summer, I think. We went up to see him, I think, last summer.
I've got a lot of respect for him. He's one of my favorites.
Yeah, he told me that they own gold. He told me that Greenlight. We talked on macro for probably 2 minutes. And, you know, I don't meet with him often. I see him every couple of years just to say hello and put my face in front of his. But at one point, the conversation turned to macro, and he said, oh, no, we own gold. You know, just like that, very matter-of-factly. He doesn't buy the bullshit either. So I respect Einhorn a lot as an investor. And by the way, as a side note, he's always, always been a very nice person to talk to. He has always, even, I think I emailed him for the first time maybe in 2012 over Questcore or Mallinckrodt. This is now before Mallinckrodt, you know, and I was nobody. I'm still nobody. But I mean, in 2012, I didn't have a Twitter account. I didn't have any shit, you know? Right. I was writing terrible articles on Seeking Alpha. And somebody gave me his email address, and he emailed me back. And I was like, that's the coolest thing in history. So, and since then, it's been, I don't know, 6-7 years. And maybe I talked to him once a year via email, maybe, if that. But he has always been a very, very nice person. And I like that too. I like that he's a great investor. I think he's very smart, and I like that he's courteous and respectful and says something about a guy when they will respond to, you know, when they're worth $1 billion or whatever he's worth, and will just respond to some rando's email.
Yeah, for sure. What about Chainos? Have you met him?
Yeah, he's also another class act.
Yeah, it seems
he's
like.
A very, very nice person. And not only do I respect his investing acumen immensely, I talked to Chainos probably a little bit more than I talked to Einhorn. Okay. But I've met Chainos in person several times, and I just think he's just aces. I think he's top class as an investor. I think he's a top class human being. We have vast differences, I know, politically. And he's one of those guys that, it's not an issue, you know? And I like that, because for me, it's not an issue either. I don't make or break my friends based on their political opinions, even though I have strong political opinions of my own. That's not how I pick and choose my friends. That's not how I pick and choose who I talk to. And I have an immense amount of respect for other people that think similarly. And, you know, I know Chainos and I have had short discussions about politics, and I know we're on very different sides of the aisle, but he doesn't bring it up, and it's, you know, he's just a very respectful person. He's a class act is really the best way to describe him. He's a class fucking act.
What do you think?
Unlike myself, who can't compliment somebody without using a profanity.
Well, I think that's got its place too, Chris. But what do you think? I mean, you understand the world of analysis a lot better than I do. I understand the macro stuff and the repo markets and the quantitative easing and Fed and all that stuff. But as far as just looking at a company's balance sheet and understanding, you know, if they can afford an acquisition or they can't, I mean, you really dive into that, which I've got a lot of respect for. So when you look at a guy like Chainos, what has made him so great for so long?
Well, to be honest with you, so first off, he's obviously an extraordinarily intelligent person. But what you find with people that are successes on Wall Street, and especially people in the short selling community, the thing that sets them apart is they do the work. Right. And, you know, I've given speeches where I've just said, if you sit down and you read a company's 10K from the beginning to the end, and by the way, if you read a 10K, you can learn everything you need to know about a company, everything. It starts with, here's where the corporate headquarters is, here's the address, here's the phone number, here's the business overview, here's where our revenue comes from, here's the segments of how we report them, here's the accounting treatment, here's the balance sheet, here's the rest of the financials, here's the management discussion analysis, here's the debt schedule, here's everything. If you read a 10K from beginning to end, you should have a damn good idea about what a company is up to and what kind of shape they're in. Now, most people don't do that. Short sellers, we love to do that because that's where the goodies are. They're in there. And we like the fact that nobody else looks at it. It's what creates inefficiencies in the market. You know, if you look at a company and just say, oh, they have $1 billion in assets, that's great. And I look at the same balance sheet and say, well, $900 million of that is goodwill and $50 million is in Eggo waffles. Well, that's paints a little bit of a different story, you know? So it's paying attention to that detail. And, you know, guys like Chainos, I mean, they're just freaks. I mean, he's just a genius. He'll look at something like Einhorn calling out the accounts receivable at Tesla. You know, you have to do some analysis. And really, it's a lot of common sense. Yeah. To make those leaps and to make that analysis, though, you have to read the financials. So these guys are already one step ahead of the game by just reading the financials. But then they really have a gifted ability to, you know, perform an analysis from there. And, you know, most of them have extensive backgrounds in short selling and fraud, so they know what red flags to look for. They question everything. They can find the smallest inconsistencies. You know, they're great forensic accountants too. You know, I'm surprised at how small of a team many of these guys have. Most of their theses are just well thought out, where they do the work. They'll read the 10K, then they'll talk to the competitors. And after they talk to the competitors, maybe they'll talk to former employees. And after they talk to former employees, maybe they'll talk to, you know, whoever. Then maybe they'll go and visit the headquarters. Well, maybe they'll try the product. You know, they just take the research to the nth degree. And truth be told, it's not that difficult. I mean, I've done research for short sellers for almost a decade, and, you know, it's just knowing where to start. You know, pull the lawsuits on this guy. Does he have a history of being sued? Does he have a history of fraud? You know, where was this executive team before they were at this company? Were they at other companies? How did those other companies do? It's just taking the time and doing the work and being comprehensive. And nobody wants to do that. It's no fun to do that. It's much easier to pull up Yahoo Finance and just say $1 billion in assets, you know, whatever, and take that at face value.
I would assume that guys like Einhorn and Chainos are constantly trying to ask themselves, where am I wrong? And trying to understand, let's say, the bull side of the argument or whatever side of the argument opposite their position. How do they do that, though? Do they invite in?
I don't know what their methodology is for doing it, but that has to be done. I mean, it has to. You want to, if you're going to take a sizable position in something, are you going to stake, you know, a claim in a company or make a big deal at it or make a presentation, you want to know the best possible bull case. Open up, you know, FactSet, find out who the top holder is, find that guy, you know, hey, so-and-so fund, why do you own this? You know, can I see your notes? Can I see your letter on this? Whatever. You have to do that. And it goes the other way around too. You know, if you're long something, you want to know why people are shorting it. You want to know what the bear case is. It's only, you know, the point of investing is to get all the cards on the table, everything possible. It's like cleaning out a house, you know, get all the shit out of the closets, get everything out of the bathroom, move it all into one room. And then from there, you can pick and sort where things go and you can kind of make your picture of whether it's a good company or not. It's vital to just objectively have as much raw data to start with as possible. And a great way to do that or to start doing that is by embracing the opposite side of the argument. I don't know what Einhorn's procedure, Chano's procedure, I don't know what their procedure is for seeking that out, to be honest with you. Right. I mean, I can only tell you what my personal procedure is, which is, you know, talk to the top shareholders if you have to. Obviously, the company has a narrative themselves. A lot of times investor presentations are great because they're different from annual filings. They'll try to just give you the bull case a little bit more, a little bit less objectively, you know, a little bit more flash. Mm. So that's always a good place to start. And yeah, that's it. Just read as much as humanly possible.
As Austrians, I don't know if I put myself in that school. I've never really put myself in a school of thought. I just try to use common sense. And it just so happens that usually comes out being on the side of the Austrians. But how important do you think it is, whatever your economic belief system is, to do the exact same thing that you're talking about with these short sellers? And that is to understand the Keynesian approach or the MMT approach.
It's extraordinarily important. I mean, it's for me, when I like get involved heavily with a name, like for instance, when I was short Herbalife for a long time, when the Ackman Icon thing was happening, mm-hmm. and I was researching it every day, relentlessly, my early followers know I would post about Herbalife every single day, many times a day. I was in the weeds was an understatement. And all I was doing was looking for a bull case to refute what I had come up with. All I was doing was looking because I felt like I had reached a terminus where I knew mathematically, at least in my opinion, the company was a pyramid scheme, that most of their, you know, revenue came from recruiting, and that is what defined a pyramid scheme. I was there. I've looked at everything that company ever published and said, they just don't have the goods to refute this. Now the FTC saw it differently, whatever. But all I did was seek out the other side to that argument and say, show me where I'm wrong. I'm happy to be proven wrong, you know? And with macro, it's the same thing. But with macro, it's like, George, you and I can look from the outside in and say, here's how the bubble works. And yeah, maybe if I buy Apple now, in 10 years, it'll be worth more because the Keynesian experiment keeps working and because the company's doing well too. And together they work wonderfully together. But a lot of people that are in the bubble can't look out and say, well, what if the tide that has been lifting everything doesn't hold up for the long haul. So I think it's very important. I always listen to the arguments of MMTers and of Keynesians and of people that advocate for all this stuff. Always, you know, right? I listen to everything that the Fed governors say. I listen to, you know, the biggest advocates. Unfortunately, you know, I find most of what they say to be ridiculous, but that doesn't mean that I'm not taking my time and trying to honestly consider it.
Yeah.
Good case in point. I did an interview with the Nigerians a couple weeks ago for this Traders for a Cause benefit. And I was making strongly the argument that companies should have had fortress balance sheets so that this slowdown would not have affected them. And John Nigerian said, well, you know what? It's different because the government forced the shutdown. And I said, you know what? That is fucking different. You're right. And I conceded that point. And I said, I never thought of it that way. You know, the government kind of owes it to people to remunerate compensation to them because they're the ones that forced these companies to shut down. That, you know, many of these restaurants may have stayed open during this crisis if the government didn't force them to shut down. Many tattoo artists would have stayed open. Many, you know, whatever, all these businesses. If it was left up to them, perhaps they would stay open and perhaps they'd still be doing business. But if the government comes in and says, you can't do it, you can't be an entrepreneur, you can't be open, maybe there is a case for the government having to compensate them for that. So I conceded that point, and I thought that was a pretty good point that I hadn't considered as well as I should have. So I'm not adverse to conceding that. I just find that after trying to objectively review as many arguments as possible and as much data as possible, I often side on the common sense side, which, as you said, happens to be the Austrian school as well.
Yeah, I've looked at, I do the exact same thing. I think it's crucial.
Like, I read like Krugman's points. You know what I mean? Like, I ridicule him sometimes. So maybe Krugman, people only see me ridiculing him.
Yeah,
like, Krugman, I think I'll read his editorials and I'll consider what he has to say.
Yeah.
I think most of the time it's asinine.
Yeah, I don't really pay attention to Krugman. I don't think he's got a... I don't think he's intellectually curious like some others that I might, kind of disagree with a little bit. But what I've seen from people who are, who their intentions are really trying to find out the truth. Let's just say on the MMT side, that the differences aren't that great.
Right.
From guys like Bob Murphy, you know, who's an Austrian. What the differences seem to be is just one's belief system in the ability of the government to do something efficiently. And if you right. believe the government is capable of doing something efficiently, well, then there might be an argument for printing up as much money as you can, because their argument is that as long as the production of goods and services stays consistent with M2, well, then you're never going to have to worry about inflation. The only thing you're going to have right. is just this booming economy forever. Where and I mathematically they're correct. Absolutely, I could not agree more. But my take on it is that the government is wildly inefficient, and if you take that approach over the long term, you're going to have some serious hell to pay, because it's going to distort the not only prices but the misallocation of resources, and then you're going to be in far worse shape. Because if you look at history, you see that governments are very poor at allocating resources and allocating capital.
Yeah, I mean, and then you have people like Ilhan Omar, who just tweeted out yesterday, cancel all rent and mortgages.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's where the MMT crowd is. And I know that she's referring to the pandemic and stimulus, but George, cancel all mortgages. I mean, not mortgage payments. She didn't say cancel mortgage payments for May. She said cancel all mortgages. I mean, that is a person that does not consider counterparties. That's a person that doesn't consider how an economy works. That's not a person that considers how a market works. Those types of things frighten me. Like, big league frighten me. Like Rashida Tlaib recommending the $1 trillion coin, which I know we talked about on the last podcast. Ideas that are absolutely massively dangerous and show zero intelligence whatsoever. With that being said, back to your argument about, you know, M2 and the production of goods and services, you make some good points. I think a lot of that is still under this umbrella of, should we have sound money or not, though? Okay. There's a big fork in the road there.
Not in my mind.
Well, I know not in your mind, but let me just say another thing too. All these people that send me these messages and they're like ridiculing me because I mentioned the gold standard. They think right. we'll never go back onto a gold standard. We can't go onto a gold standard. The idea of a gold standard is... None of these people realize, you know, I'm not talking about going back to $35 an ounce gold standard. You know, we can go to a gold standard that is 1/1 trillionth of an ounce of gold to $1. As long as we peg it to something at some value that limits the supply, it is in essence, I mean, gold obviously would be the obvious thing to peg it to. That could still provide some stability and could still demotivate the government from doing the things that it's doing now, which is exactly why we had the gold standard to begin with, which is to prevent the government from doing exactly what it's doing now. So yes, we can go back to a gold standard. People think we're going to put on fucking like mining hats and go back to the 1800s, you know, where everybody's going to look like Yosemite Sam. We're all going to be carrying around six shooters. Like, yeehaw, we're going back to the fucking gold standard. Doesn't have to be like that. It can be a very, very, very simple thing. The central bank holds X in reserve. X amount of gold is pegged to X amount of money. That's it. It doesn't have to be $35 an ounce. It could be, again, like I said, one one, it could be on a subatomic level, you know, one quark of gold to $1, but we just have to put something in place that assigns an actual value to the money and most importantly prevents us from printing more of it. Yeah. That's the most important thing.
And I think people, and I don't want to generalize too much, but it seems as though people on the left are a little more receptive to this type of fiat money system, or the, you know, because in general, they're more receptive to kind of a central planning thing.
They come out of universities where they've been indoctrinated with what economics and monetary policy has been over the last 40 years, and that's the correct way to do things. And they get their degree from Columbia or their degree from Harvard, and they think that the way that it's set up now is the end all be all, and we've got it all figured out. And they never even get to a point where they question it. They never even get there. Sometimes they just stay in the bubble forever. And fiat sits right in there. It plays.
But what I find fascinating is that they'll say that we need fiat money because of the central banks know what they're doing. We need to manage interest rates. We need to do all these things. But then they'll also forget that fiat money gives the government the power to go to war.
Right.
So it's like,
well, and also that it taxes people in other ways that they don't realize.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right, buddy. Well, it's been a great talk. I don't want
to, George, if you say to somebody, I'm going to give you one of these two things. I'm going to give you $2,000 in US dollars or $2,000 in gold, and you have to hold it for 5 years. How many of the people are going to pick US dollars? Even right now, with the system that
probably
is
every one of my viewers, the 100,000 people that are subscribing to my YouTube channel.
You know what I mean, though?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I mean, the argument against fiat is just, it's one of those unfortunate situations where we have to wait to be proven right. And I don't even know if I want to be proven right, but you can't argue with the integrity of the points that we're trying to make and the moral hazard that comes with fiat. I mean, it's gross. It's really nasty.
Yeah. And also, too, I don't think that people truly understand how detrimental long-term inflation is, because they just see it at
2%,
3%. But if you compound that, you know, going back to 1913, we've had, call it 2,000% inflation since the Fed was created.
And those are the CPI numbers that we know about.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's a whole other rabbit hole as well. But just assuming that the CPI is correct and we've had 2,000% inflation, people say, oh, okay, I get it. But, you know, prices go up, but my wages go up kind of, so it's a wash. And is it really
just
that
how big? Things go, right?
Yeah, but they really don't think it through. And I remember I did a video that kind of opened up my eyes when I did the research, and I thought through someone, I probably told you this story, but if they're working at McDonald's, you know, if you go through like the 1800s when we had 50% deflation from 1800 to 1900, meaning prices went down by 50%. And then of course the Keynesians come back, well, if we had deflation, then no one would be able to pay the debt and it'd be this doom spiral. But what they don't understand is, especially in the late 1800s, we had deflation where prices were going down on consumer goods, but wages were going up in nominal terms. And GDP in nominal terms was positive with 4% interest rates while you had prices going down. So if you think about that same worker, that I don't care if you're making 10 grand a year, 50 grand a year, 500 a year, it doesn't matter. If you have the cost of what you buy on a daily basis going down by 3% per year, compounded over 10 or 20 years. Yeah, that's right. And while your wages are staying the same or going up by 1%.
You get a monstrous boost to your purchasing power.
Exactly.
You know, it used to be, lower prices used to be a reward for saving,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Think what that not only does to your purchasing power, but think about what that does to poverty. Think about what that does to everyone who's making minimum wage right now or would be making minimum wage in 10 years or something like that.
Right.
Which makes the whole society richer. And it really frustrates me, especially when I hear the Fed talk about how that's their actual objective, is to hit 2 or 3% inflation per year. And then you take it a step further, and what it does is it forces everyone to be invested in financial assets. Because if you just leave your money in the bank,
right, you don't get any interest.
Yeah, where if you would have done that in 1800s, you'd have a 7% real return per year with cash. Right. Just right. I mean, think about that. Think about getting a 7% real rate of return in your checking account. I mean,
sick, right?
Yeah. What would that also do to people's mentality when it comes to saving, investing, just going back to the whole Austrian mindset?
Yeah, well, it would make people far more shrewd, and it would get people, you know, it would really create some stability for individuals and would put people on and businesses on a lot better footing than they are now. I mean, we can talk about any variable in the economic system and how much more efficient and better it gets when you reverse the Keynesian nonsense and start moving the wheel in the other direction to the Austrian school. Everything just makes more sense. You're rewarded for saving. You know, your purchasing power goes up. You know, all of these wonderful things that drive production happen. There's less inefficiency. There's less misallocation of resources. There's less government waste. It just makes more sense, you know? And, but what are we going to do? I mean, we have a central bank that's full of sociopaths that think that that are arrogant enough to think that they have it figured out and that this is it, what we're doing. I mean, I don't know if Jerome Powell goes home at night and before he goes to bed ever stops and just thinks like, man, I hope I don't have this fucking thing ass backwards, because if I do, I'm going to be in some deep, deep shit. And, you know, I said this about Yellen after she left and passed the buck to Powell. After Powell had been in charge for, I don't know, a couple of months, Yellen peeked her head back in and had to make some comment somewhere on some program. I don't forget what it was. But, I think it was when she came out and said, there's never going to be another financial crisis in my lifetime. And even then, before the coronavirus, I was thinking, wow, that's a dumb fucking thing to say, number one. But number two, shouldn't you shut up? Shouldn't you just be happy that you were able to kind of pass the flaming bag of dog shit to the next person, and maybe it'll collapse on his? I can't believe it didn't collapse on Yellen's watch. That's unbelievable. That's like one of the best getaways in history. She should be on a beach right now doing body shots off somebody in Cancun and partying. She shouldn't be like weighing back in, because she's not going to be looked at favorably over the course of history. As Peter Schiff famously said in one of his last interviews on CNBC, they were, you know, what do you think of Janet Yellen? She's totally incompetent. Which is just funny to, because it's so matter of fact for him how ass backwards they have everything. So it's funny to listen to him talk about these people that are heralded as the foremost experts in their field as just completely having it wrong. And he's very matter of factly about it. So these people are so arrogant. I don't know, willfully, or if it's just a product of their education. I don't know, but they think that they've got it figured out, George. And we think that maybe they don't. So I think who knows?
I think they think their models have it figured out.
Not the models.
And because they try to make it scientific to the extreme. Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe they're just under so much pressure that they have that conversation with themselves, that internal dialogue you just referred to. And maybe their default, just to alleviate some of the pressure, is to be like, you know what, this is so much pressure, I can't make these decisions on my own. So I'm just gonna let the models make the decision, then I don't have to live with the results. You know?
The models are there to justify the decisions that they've already made in their mind.
Oh, you think?
I think that's, look at what just happened now with, you know, I think heading into this coronavirus pandemic, people at the Fed wanted 0% rates and they wanted to unleash this bazooka, you know, and they were already kind of tipping their hand before the pandemic. They were lowering rates at the, you know, 11 years into a bull market. They were lowering rates with unemployment at, you know, 3% and with the market at all-time highs, they were lowering rates.
Yeah.
So I think the Fed's only mandate is the stock market. And I think that their actions post-pandemic were a foregone conclusion before the pandemic. They just needed a little touch in the right direction. And that's what we saw. We saw one day, you know, hey, the coronavirus could be a problem. And the next day it was, we're doing unlimited QE, plus we're buying junk bonds. Have a nice day. I mean, it was just like They didn't even stop to think about it. They didn't consider moral hazard. They had their mind made up already. They just needed George. They were right there. They were right on the edge. They just need somebody to fucking breathe on them the right way and just go, you know, that was it. And then that was it. It's like, oh, open the floodgates, unlimited everything for everybody. So the models, I think, are there to justify the system that they have in place, which is a system to just keep complacency in the short term and keep political people, you know, and elected officials elected and in position, and just bide their time for another day or another week. And the models, they kind of make everything look good. Hey, check this out. We've got Microsoft Excel Professional Edition, and we used a bunch of fucking formulas. So we know what we're doing.
Yeah. Don't you think their mandate is also inflation to, and I'm not just talking about the 2%. I think it's their real mandate if you, you know, got them. Inflate away the debt for the government. Yeah.
Might be. Wouldn't surprise me. Yeah. That and the stock market. Maybe that's their new dual mandate. Yeah,
that's the way I see it. Stock market and make sure there's inflation to inflate away the government debt. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense.
All right, buddy. Well, in the interest of time, we're going to leave it there. I appreciate you coming on. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. For any of my viewers who might not know where to find your stuff and your content, where can they go?
You can just find me on Quote the Raven podcast. You can just find it online. I don't like to promote a lot, but I will say this. Thank you for having me on. This is the first time of the last several times that you had me on where I didn't invite myself onto your show. Last time I was like, hey, I got a bunch of shit I want to say. Can I come on your thing and say it? And you were like, yeah, okay. This time you actually reached out to me and you were like, would you like to come on? I was like, wow, that's like an unsolicited invitation. But I would also like for you to come back on my podcast because you are much smarter at macro than I am. And I love listening to you hear it and you can really get going. And so I always try to take the lead a little bit more when I'm on your show. And I like to defer that back to you when you're on mine. So please come on my podcast some point soon.
Anytime, buddy. You always have an open invitation.
Awesome. Thanks so much, George. It was a pleasure as always.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.